are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on today's show, Matthew John, is Managing Director of Last Forest Enterprise, a social enterprise and market intermediary for wild forest produce. Matthew is helping protect indigenous communities who have been sustainably harvesting honey for thousands of years from honey cliffs and bee nesting trees. He's a pioneer championing organic producers in the Nilgiri Biosphere Reserve, the first in India designated by UNESCO. Matthew is well known in the fair trade world, and under his stewardship, Last Forest Peer Review Accreditation, the participatory guarantee system, was recently adopted by the Government of India. Thank you for being a guest on the podcast, Matthew. To start with, tell our listeners something about your upbringing and background.
A little bit about myself. I've grown up in the north, in the state of Uttar Pradesh, in the city of Varanasi, which is considered holy for a large part of our population in this country. So I spent my schooling years there, and then I moved out. I moved out for my graduation to the south, and then I moved for my post-graduation to Gujarat. So I've been sort of traveling all over the country, now based here. So I'm more or less a resident of the Nilgiris in Tamil Nadu. It's part of the Western Ghats. And so the Western Ghats are a very important part of this country, of its agroclimatic zone, because it forms the lungs for this country on the western side in a region which is a little bit of a dry zone. But we receive rain for a long part of the year, and it's quite cold up here. It's 2,000 meters above sea level.
Nilgiri is, of course, one of the most beautiful parts of India. But tell us about your entrepreneurial journey. How did that start?
The entrepreneurial journey is a little bit of an offshoot, because after college, you tend to look for the best jobs. And I'm talking about the early, late 80s. And I moved to Delhi, and I worked with an organization based there for about 3-4 years. And then you realize that in Delhi, you tend to attend a huge number of meetings. You tend to write a huge number of reports. And that's not something that I was looking forward to. And so with friends, moved out and created for ourselves a space around honey, because that was something that interested all of us. And we spent a year traveling all over Tamil Nadu, backpacking, looking for people who collect honey. And I will continue to refer to them as honey hunters, because they collect honey from the wild. And we realized that when you start this development process, most of the time we look at environmental issues, we look at development issues, but we tend to leave the market out of the mix, which in a sense is part of the triad of conservation, livelihoods, and enterprise. And if you don't have the mix, you may move forward, but it will never be complete. And many times in the development context, we tend to avoid the market, because we see it as a different beast. We don't want to engage with it. But for us, it was very important that we engage with this part. And so right from the mid-90s, we engaged with the market. We tried to create our own brand and move forward. But finally, in 2010, as an organization, we decided that we needed to free up Last Forest as an organization, which we incubated at that point of time. That allowed us the freedom to be able to engage with the customer side, which is very challenging, because the market is very dynamic. It does not respect many of the ethics and values that you would like to keep close to your heart. But then I think that's the exciting challenge of being a social enterprise.
There's some very interesting points there. As you mentioned, that the development agenda leaves the market part of the conversation out most of the time. Last Forest also acts as an aggregator for local produce, but you also have bricks and mortar. Do you guarantee income to your producers? And do correct me where I'm wrong.
I just want to follow up on the previous question after your comments. When we work from the development side in the market space, we tend to come very highly from the producer side because that's where our engagement is. We would like to give good prices to the producer. We would like to give them a guarantee in terms of prices. We tend to deal with the customer and the market. Here is the product. Take it or leave it. You should buy it just because it comes from small communities. It comes from marginalized sets of people. And we then tend to leave it, but not engage with that set of customers. But they would like where the product is coming from, the story behind the product. And finally, for a customer, the product has to make sense. There has to be a quality part of it, and there has to be a functionality part of it. And if those two don't meet, then it's an empathetic purchase, but it's not a purchase that will continue to happen. In our journey, we kept both sides in focus, both the producer side and the customer side. Do we tend to guarantee income? I don't think we can fully guarantee that. But what we try and do is we know that there is a certain set of people that we work with, and we have them employed more or less throughout the year. All of the producers at our producer centers, they are all women. For us, that is a very solid point of interaction, that these women are able to earn an income while they are in their village.
Some very good points there. How has COVID-19 impacted your business and local communities?
Remember, for us, we do 40% of our revenues during the summer season because this is a tourist spot. And so the prep for that starts all the way in January itself. And just when it was about to start, we had the pandemic come in and it just wiped us out. What was fabulous was that even before the lockdown started, we had taken cognizance of this, that there may be an impact. And so we really started talking to our team that difficult times are ahead. What was phenomenal was that we put it out to our board and they immediately held emergency meetings to even look at a zero revenue scenario, the worst case scenario. So that allowed all of us to be extremely prepared mentally to deal with that. At a producer end, it was a disaster for these communities because there was no sale, there was no income, there was no way that you could reach out to them because movement was restricted. So that became a huge hit. But for the team of people who are part of Last Forest, what we were able to say is that you will continue to work with us. The board has taken a decision that nobody will be fired. There will be no cuts in salaries. Maybe we'll do deferred salaries, but we will go through this. There was a lot of pivoting done at that point of time because Last Forest as an organization was never into making masks. And I think it was the same for many other organizations around the world. I think the fair trade community, they were phenomenal at this point of time because they put organizations who were already doing such things together. Discussions were held and we were able to make masks and sell through. I think two other things happened. One is we kept our e-commerce site open right through. And we told customers, we are there with you, but we need your support also at this point of time. There were customers who bought in. They waited for sometimes over a month for their products to be delivered, but they knew that the cash that was required by the organization was crucial. And so they paid upfront. The second thing that I think was phenomenal was that we were pivoting early this year towards the export side, and the fair trade community, they were great in the way they placed their orders at that point of time because it allowed production to take place in the villages. It allowed cash flow for us. That, in a nutshell, is how we survived the pandemic. And I think we've gone through the worst period, but it has allowed us to face the future with confidence, knowing that the team is strong enough to deal with this sort of a worst case scenario.
There are some amazing learnings from COVID-19. It's very encouraging to hear that you all were able to quickly turn around and make a plan and move from there. I read somewhere that Last Forest had devised a local version of fair trade certification that has now been adopted by the government. This was sometime back.
That's not fair trade, but it's organic certification. I think the organic world struggles with many times is the process of certification. If I go back in time, in the late 60s, early 70s, when the organic movement was gaining ground, there was a tremendous enthusiasm in the organic world to be recognized by the state that they were able to follow their principles and create a niche in the market. This recognition by the state also had its downsides. When it became part of the state policies, then you bring in a whole set of policies, criteria that had to come into place. But what it did in this whole process was that it left the small and marginal farmers out of the certification process. So rather than certification becoming an enabler, it sort of ring-fenced a certain set of people who could afford that. And it also assumed that you were literate enough, you were able to deal with paperwork, and you had enough financial capability to be able to bear those costs. And at that point, many groups tried to stay out of it, but then when you had to engage with the market, it became very difficult. So many of us, not only Last Forest and its parent institution, Keystone Foundation, but many other groups around the world, they tended to find local solutions which made sense in a local market. All these groups came together in the early 2000s. And today we have a system which is called the participatory guarantee systems. This is something that is recognized worldwide, and it allows small producers, farmers to peer review each other and to be able to put that process through a form of guarantee out into the market. Today, this has been recognized in India as a credible system. The government has adopted this, and it has become part of the market system. This is not only true in India, but in many other parts of the world. I think Latin America is one large area which has adopted and taken pioneering steps to constantly evolve and come up with different ways of how the customer engages with the producer at that level.
Very interesting. So this peer review system, is it cumbersome or is it something that is easy to follow, easy to facilitate for the producers?
One key part of this peer review system is that there are enablers in terms of civil society organizations who are able to put the process together. So you could have many farmers, but you need a facilitation organization that is able to put this data together and to be able to curate it so that it is available for diligence at any point of time. It depends on you whether you want to make it cumbersome, which normally is there in a third-party system. Yeah. You tend to, because of one fault, you create a new system just to correct that fault. That fault may be by just 5%, but you push the other 95% into that system. So in PGS, I think it is the approach and how you deal in certain contexts. There may be areas where even if you have a local language, many places people are not able to read and write. You can still videograph the entire conversation. And that becomes richer guarantee rather than just a yes and a no. And that, I think, is much more relevant today because customers would like to know that story.
I came to know about Last Forest from a story I read in 30 States. It was about the honey hunters. Tell us something about it. I was fascinated, and I shared that story with so many people across.
I always go back to, stating that, if you talk about who is a carpenter or who's a plumber, we have a picture in our head and we understand what that term means. For many people, the word hunting tends to take them back to the picture that they create in their heads is of primitive, you know, technology or primitive activities taking place. What we fail to understand is it's an activity that has survived thousands of years and it has evolved based on the conditions that they are in. And so many of these communities, because we tend to look at wild, at forest, at raw, from a very negative perspective, that this is not hygienic, this is not safe, there are no safety processes in place, we tend to push people into acknowledging something of theirs which they are not, and try to push them into those spaces. But these set of people, they have continued this activity for thousands of years. Today, many of the younger generation are taking to it. In this process, they allow a relationship with nature, and so we never understand. For us, climate change might just be a term that we use in meetings, but climate change for them is a reality. When there are unseasonal rains or there is a drought, it impacts the production of honey, and that's their livelihood. And how do they deal with that? Earlier, honey that they harvested would have been used as a barter product. Today, everything has turned to cash. Many of these communities are not equipped to deal with those scenarios. For us, it was an opportunity to be able to do that interface between these communities, tell their story, and take the product out into the market.
It was fascinating. The story mentioned that they do not take all the honey away, and there are certain rituals that they have followed for thousands of years, and you respect that because they're looking at a sustainable future.
I think many of these traditions which they have would have come through their understanding of the forest and nature. That's where slowly it becomes a tradition and part of that culture. So when they collect honey from these bees, there is a harvest which is in sync with the bees at that point of time, that they never take away 100% of the combs, that they sing to the bees when they come down the forest made ladders. They leave as sacred places, and those become gene pools for the next generation of bees. So I think their understanding of the ecology is much more than we give credit, because we come from education defined by us. We never see their knowledge as an education that they have been through and a life journey that they have been through. And I think it's important then for us to unlearn many of the things that we have learned to be able to understand what they are speaking or showing us.
Last Forest invests 40% of profits into developing local communities. What has been the impact of that?
Last Forest was incubated in 2010, and the mother institution remains a non-profit organization, which is Keystone Foundation, that works with many of these communities. And so Last Forest is able to donate some amount back to Keystone to be able to carry out work in these communities, specifically gave for activities like health, for running a community newspaper, for running a community radio. I think some of this also goes back directly to producers as dividends. So Keystone also incubated another organization, which is a producer company, which works with the producers directly. And that organization, which has over 1,600 members, is able to receive some of the profits from Last Forest and is able to then plow it back as dividends to these collectors.
You mentioned a collaboration with Stanford. Tell us more about it.
A couple of years ago, Stanford has started a program in India at which they look at small enterprises, and they could range from social enterprises like Last Forest to other enterprises in the field of hospitality, in the field of technology, education. And Last Forest was selected to be part of a cohort which went through this year-long educational experience. And what was great about this Stanford experience was that it was not just a classroom teaching, but professors and facilitators from their core team got involved with the senior team in Last Forest into being able to sort of question you know, your mission, your vision, to be able to deal with nitty-gritties like accounts receivables, account payables, and things like that. And so your purpose became very strong and your sense of identity sort of evolved during that year-long process. What it has also done is that it has brought a whole set of people together. And so you now have a bank of people who are from different walks of life, and you are able to draw on these sets of people. You are able to share, you are able to learn from others' experiences. And I think for Last Forest, that has been a great learning curve, because one, to be recognized as an organization that could be part of such a training, but also for the senior team that they went through this transformation process and the organization as to how you plan and evolve for the years going forward.
Let's come back to India and 104 million indigenous people. A lot of them we know are in dire straits with deforestation, culture dying on. It is nigh impossible to keep modernization away. What can we do to protect their culture and identity?
Unless you equip the communities themselves to deal with this, it's not something we can control. We are always outsiders. I may work here 50 years. I will always remain somebody who comes from a different life experience. And so unless you equip these communities that they can deal with many of these scenarios, whether they can be part of decision-making bodies, whether they can engage with the political class, all of this we have to be able to facilitate so that they are able to engage and make decisions. Very importantly is you can put forward choices and the decisions are theirs. Decisions are not ours to make. If you constantly work, train, give them enough exposure of how many communities around the world have dealt with this. In our own country, we have so many of these communities, some of whom have become very strong and are able to voice themselves. So I think also that we must get people who are in urban spaces to recognize this set of people, because then we value them. We value their diversity. We tend to look at everything in a very homogenized manner. And we are very comfortable within that scenario because diversity makes us uncomfortable. It asks questions of us, whether it is color, whether it is the clothes we wear, whether it is the beliefs we hold, all of that. And I think it is important that the large growing urban set of people are able to recognize this diversity in our own country and to be able to value that. And if our children are taught to respect that, to respect such sets of people, we know that there are so many other sets of people, even in urban spaces, that need to be recognized. And we all of us tend to shy away from these issues. If we take these issues out, constantly talk, dialogue, there will always be a small subset of people who will oppose. But they should not be driving our agendas. They should not be driving the future. But if we engage, we will always see hope ahead.
So I come back to the questions around Indigenous people and the Indian Forest Rights Act and how far it goes to protecting the rights of local communities. Last year, there was a case in the Supreme Court and it asked for evictions of Indigenous communities. And this case was brought by wildlife organizations. So this is sort of a strange situation where, you know, the people who should be on the same side are actually on different sides of the fence. How do you resolve this issue?
So most organizations tend to be on one side. So either you are for the people or you are for the environment. And we never see the two together. We need the communities and we need the environment. And they both need to be in harmony. And they have lived together in harmony. We have created these divisions of whether these are wildlife areas or whether these are tourism spaces. And so this issue that came up last year, I think there is a gap of knowledge that exists that allowed the courts to come up with this sort of a conclusion. From my point of view, these communities are actually stewards of these spaces. They have taken care of these spaces for thousands of years. They have not been the reason that these forests have destroyed. Their footprint, their ecological footprint is negligible. It has never destroyed that diversity and that environment. So to take such a strong opinion, I think this needs to be re-looked at, because I don't see them as the perpetrators of the crimes that we are talking about.
Interesting. Last Forest is a purpose-driven business. Does purpose equal sustainability?
I think that remains a tough space to be in, but we took this conscious decision that it will be an enterprise that will sustain. It has sustained these 10 years without grants. It is able to meet all its expenses, and it is also able to meet the ethics and value systems that it has imbibed and it has started with. So I think the journey is longer and it's more difficult. You are bringing in a business sense and you are bringing in ethics and values. If you are trying to fuse them in our present scenario, it is tough, but I think it is possible. We've shown it over 10 years that it has worked. I think it needs a whole new younger generation to step into these spaces. Their understanding of the world, their understanding of the market, they need to bring that perspective into these businesses. We have made huge mistakes in the last 50, 60 years. We have destroyed large parts of our planet. And we are now handing over a planet which is not so great, but I think there is hope that we will go forward. I think this hope sustains all of us.
Definitely does. What are the things that Last Forest has achieved that you are really proud of?
A couple of things. I think that it has stuck to its value systems, that it works with small communities. It works on organic and fair trade principles. It is concerned about biodiversity issues. It provides local employment. These are very strong values for the organization, and it has not compromised on them. Number two, it has made an impact on the communities that it works with, that it provides them employment, women at the forefront of these communities, and that there is an income that goes back into these spaces. Another one is that it has engaged on the market side with many of the same principles that the market uses. So it has very strong branding, packaging, quality parameters. This is what the market understands. And it has been able to deal in the mainstream market and build a brand for itself. This is something to be extremely proud of, because not many development institutions create a brand. And I think that brand creation and recall for customers about the quality and what the organization stands for, I think is something that I'm very proud of.
Definitely things to be proud of. The last question, name three people who inspire you.
I think my mom, she inspired me to chart a path which was not the normal MBA graduate path to moving into a corporate space. Her one concern was always whether I was happy doing what I was doing, and then it was worth doing. And I think that is something that I carry to this day. The communities that we work with, coming from an urban space, I never knew such a world existed. What I have learned from them is phenomenal. So I have learned to keep my mouth shut and hear what they are saying and not put my jargon out to them. And I think they continue to inspire me with their simplicity and their thought processes and understanding of the environment, which is way beyond what we think and learn.
Thank you for being a guest on the show, Matthew. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
I enjoyed speaking to you too, Sudha.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.